Hey humans, you know, putting on your pants is a lot like using a VPN. It keeps the important stuff private, and if you don't get around to doing it before you need to, you find yourself unexpectedly exposed. Hallelujah, Surfshark VPN is giving you 4 extra months of their military-grade encryption at surfshark.com/joshs, or by using the code joshs at checkout. You know, without a virtual private network, you're a sitting duck for snoopers and trackers and identity theft and fraud, especially on public Wi-Fi, which I use a lot at libraries and airports and such, which is one reason I use Surfshark VPN. That's not the only reason, though, the privacy stuff. Speaking of airports, you should take a look at what happens when you turn on Surfshark VPN and you start browsing flights and hotel reservations from different regions. There are location-based price differences. This is a little secret travel hack to save you money. Hotels and airlines and travel booking sites offer different prices to different countries. And with surfshark.com/joshs, you can be anywhere you want to be. Plus, wherever you are, a Surfshark VPN also enables you to stream your favorite shows or access websites that are geo-blocked from the region that you're actually in. With Surfshark, you can break through all the online barriers and access content from all over the world. So don't let online threats catch you off guard. Take control of your online security with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Go to surfshark.com/joshs or use the code joshs at checkout to get 4 extra months of Surfshark VPN and secure your digital life. G'day, humans. Welcome to the safe space for dangerous ideas. Here's an uncomfortable question for you. How did we all get so damn rich? In comparison to most people who have ever lived, we are staggeringly materially wealthy. And yet now we are at a funny moment with Mamdani's win in the mayoral election in New York, Elon Musk's $1 trillion payday, Instagram influencers embracing communism, Bernie Sanders, AOC, Donald Trump's tariffs, protectionism, Chinese communism. There's a fundamental reevaluation of the economic assumptions that have underpinned the neoliberal order that we've lived under for the past half century. But those assumptions, and I'm not just talking about policies like free trade and low taxes, but the very structure of how we live our lives, how we get stuff, how we produce stuff, those assumptions like the existence of money and markets and wages are not God-given. They're not woven into the very fabric of nature. They are contingent. They're arbitrary. They evolved over the course of the past 1,000 years, and they are what has made you materially better off than almost any other person who ever existed. Today's guest, Professor Sven Beckett, is a professor of history at Harvard University and one of the world's leading historians of capitalism. He's not a mindless free market cheerleader. He's not a libertarian economist who's just defending free markets in an unfettered way. He's a thoughtful economic historian who studies with forensic precision how in the real world violence and coercion and even empire were foundational to capitalism's rise, but also how capitalism remains the indispensable model for human prosperity. He got his PhD in history at Columbia University. He was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in 2014, and his new book is called Capitalism, A Global History, a somewhat ambitious title. He joined me from his office in Harvard University to shed light on what capitalism is, how it came about, and in this era of populism and tariffs and a new socialist New York mayor, how we might re-anchor capitalism in moral and ecological limits without extinguishing the creativity that has made it the most productive engine of all time. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. The one, the only, Sven Beckett. I'm intrigued by what's going on in the States at the moment, especially the sort of populist right and also the populist left, Trump's tariffs and also Mamdani's win in New York City, and no one quite knowing what to make of all of that. What do you make of it as an expert on capitalism?
I have thought a lot about the history of capitalism. I have thought a lot about the past 1,000 years, and I've thought a lot about how we came into the world in which we live in right now, in which capitalism is one of the major processes that structures our lives. And in the book, I don't have much to say or really nothing to say about the future, because obviously predicting the future is a risky business because you can be proven to be wrong. But it does a historical perspective. Thinking about the 1,000-year history of capitalism, I think does help us find the categories about how to think about the present, and helps us ask some questions of the present that are perhaps relevant to come to a better understanding of it. And so what we see in the long history of capitalism is that capitalism is undogmatic. It does take on very different forms in its history. And in one way, it is undogmatic, and that is that it embeds itself and thrives within very different kinds of political regimes. And of course, in the United States, as in Australia, as in Western Europe, we have seen that in the past, in the 20th century, at least in some parts of the world throughout the 20th century, like in England and Australia and the United States, we have seen that capitalism was embedded within a form of liberal and democratic rule. And there was the belief that capitalism forevermore would be embedded in that form of political rule, that indeed the expansion of capitalism and the expansion of forms of liberal democratic rule would go hand in hand. But if you look at the present, you're beginning to doubt that this is indeed the case. You see that there are plenty of perfectly capitalist societies that are moving towards more authoritarian forms of rule, and in some ways, if you look at the whole history of capitalism, this doesn't come as much of a surprise, because you see that capitalism has gone along with very different kinds of forms of political rule. That's the first point. The second point is, we live in a world of rapid technological change. We see the emergence of, computer-related industries and artificial intelligence, which might lead to enormous productivity gains, and of course, and enormous social upheaval. And that's also something you see throughout the history of capitalism. So that's the second point. The third point is that economic power within the world is shifting quite drastically. For about 200 years, Europe and the United States were kind of at the center of the global economy. But now nobody in their right minds would, ignore developments in Asia to understand the contemporary economy. And again, that is a kind of shape-shifting of global capitalism that is quite radical. But again, from a historical perspective, it is not particularly surprising. And fourth, to end this, we see a radical sharpening of social inequality in many societies. In the United States, certainly, in many parts of Europe. I don't know exactly about Australia, but perhaps there is.
It's getting a little worse, but it's nowhere near American levels.
Yeah. So I think in the United States, the degree of social inequality that we see now can only be characterized as just kind of absurd, like this tiny group of people capturing almost all gains from productivity advances in the American economy. And that said, it seems that this is politically unsustainable. And so the political responses we see in the United States, such as the rise of Donald Trump and the successes of Mandani in New York City, I think are directly related to these kinds of sea changes that are taking place in global capitalism, but also more particularly in American
capitalism. And just when you say that there's no necessary link between capitalism and liberal democracy, which is a taboo thing to say for many people on the conservative right of politics who have long held that if you just open up markets, then human rights will follow. What are you thinking of when you say that there are some countries that we see that are thoroughly capitalist but do not have liberal democracy? Are you thinking of Hungary and countries like that have become more authoritarian?
Yeah, you can, exactly. You can think of Hungary. You can think of Turkey. You can think of India. There was this expectation. I remember that very clearly in the 1990s or 2000s. And the idea was, now with the end of the Cold War, the world is becoming more capitalist. And as a result, by necessity, the world will also become politically more like the United States. It will transition into a kind of democratic liberal form of governance. What we are seeing is just the opposite. We are seeing that more authoritarian forms of governance now are coming into the centers of kind of the heartland of liberal democracy.
But isn't, sorry to just pick on that, isn't the free marketeers' pushback to that, that actually, yes, there's a rise in authoritarianism, but it's always inevitably coupled with an erosion of human rights at the same time, because the governments just can't help themselves from bossing around the economy, giving favors to their mates, warping the free market in ways that benefit them and their cronies, and that therefore there is something inconsistent about a genuinely free and open market and a repressive regime. Like, as Hungary becomes more authoritarian, it will necessarily become less capitalist. Turkey is no bastion of capitalism. India has this crazy bureaucratic system which favors, some companies over others. Russia is obviously a crony kleptocracy. I don't see many examples of countries that have genuinely free markets where authoritarian rulers are not interfering in the economy.
No, that is, I think, absolutely true. And on a conceptual level, yes, clearly there is a link between free and open markets and also a particular form of governance. That is all true. But this does not reflect the real history of capitalism. Okay. And my book is very much an effort, not so much to kind of write the imagined history of capitalism or as capitalism should have been or could have been.
In the minds of Ayn Rand and Rand Paul.
It's not a kind of illustration of your economics textbook. It's not picking history for evidence that the laws that are depicted in economics textbooks are indeed true. It is instead an effort to understand capitalism as it actually unfolded. And what you can see there is that in every moment in capitalism's history, the state came to play an exceedingly important role in structuring capitalism. Of course, the way how the state has done so changes drastically. Again, the difference between forms of authoritarian rule and forms of liberal democratic rule are instructive in that regard. But still, under all forms of political rule, the state has been absolutely crucial to capitalism's history. And so to think that somehow the state is kind of oppositional to free markets is, I think, historically completely wrong. I think the free market, so to speak, is in some ways also a construction of the state. It relies upon the state for its very construction.
Right. I mean, it relies on the state to uphold property rights. It relies on the state to have courts that will enforce those property rights. It relies on the state for things like intellectual property and copyright and so on. But isn't the free market argument that is all that the state should do, and that the reason why free markets are opposed to statism is because there's an extra sphere of state activity which constitutes aggressive micromanagement of the economy, which is not consistent with capitalism?
Yes, no, that's again absolutely true. That is the argument. And indeed, in the last 50 years, when we lived under a more neoliberal order, this kind of micromanagement of economic decisions or even corporate decisions by government officials was considered to be totally unacceptable. I mean, today the New York Times reports that the U.S. government now is investing in a whole panoply of American companies and taking shares in these companies and also influencing their management decisions. So this seems to me completely at odds with the neoliberal project of the past 50 years. That is true. But still, all of that said, the state has played an incredibly important role. Even under the neoliberal order, it has done much more than just to secure property rights or enforce court rulings or enabled the creation of a legal structure in which contracts were embedded. It has done much, much more. It has, it has built massive infrastructures. It has invested massively in military power. It has massively invested in education systems, healthcare, and social welfare. So, I think historically the state grew up hand in hand with the expansion of capitalism. Even if this is considered to be ideologically, two things that are opposed to one another, and on a conceptual level, they are, of course, in tension with one another. But historically, they have emerged hand in hand with one another. And thus, the contemporary move towards new forms of state intervention, which seem so contra to the neoliberal ideas that we have lived with in the past 50 years. They are departure from the neoliberal era, but I see them perhaps, unlike others, I see them as a little less radical a departure than is sometimes now commented
right
in the media. Because I see that, throughout the history of capitalism, it's, being protectionist, as you know, is not an invention of the 21st century. I mean, it's pretty much a constant throughout the history of capitalism.
Well, is it a constant throughout the history of capitalism, or is it a constant throughout the history of the struggle between free capital and statism?
I think the whole notion of these two forces being kind of irreconcilably at odds with one another is just mistaken. I think what you just mentioned, what is statism, has played an enormously important role in creating the so-called free market. The so-called free market has, of course, also played an enormous role in enabling the kind of vast expansion of state power that we have seen in the past 200 or 300 years. So I don't see them as contradictory at all. I mean, there are different configurations possible. Of course, there is a great difference between the order we're living in, we are now entering, and the order we just left behind. Yes, that's clear. The state does different things. And we obviously need to recognize that. But I think it's more kind of a reconfiguration of state power and a reconfiguration of capitalism than it is, kind of a mortal struggle
right.
of the one with
yeah.
the other.
I mean, what's interesting about this moment to me, and one interesting thing that I got from your book, is your book really tries to help us to imagine going back to first principles and realizing sort of how contingent capitalism is, that a lot of the assumptions about that we just carry with us about the way that the world works, the way that economies work, the way that people work, the way that people trade, the way that the geography of countries is set up between cities and agriculture, a lot of this is that we assume is sort of baked into the state of nature are actually aspects of capitalism that could have been otherwise. And the consensus that we've had over the course of my lifetime, which is that tariffs are bad, free trade is good, socialism doesn't work, are now being questioned by significant swathes of the population, with the President of the United States reintroducing tariffs, the new mayor of New York promising state-owned grocery shops and free buses. I'm just interested in what that sea change means psychologically amongst all of us.
No, it means, look, I think there you're absolutely right. We lived in the past 50 years, we lived in something that I call in the book the neoliberal order. And this neoliberal order was spectacularly successful also because, for the reasons that you just cited, that this particular kind of capitalism was made out to be natural. It was seen as kind of the height of human development. It was just the best possible word, and it was seen and described as being in sync with what are allegedly the natural laws that govern a capitalist society. And now, if somebody comes along and says, wait, we're going to create government-owned grocery stores, or wait, we're going to, build tariff wars to protect domestic industry, we see that almost like as a violation of the laws of nature, because we've been taught for 50 years that this is how the world works, or if it doesn't work like this, it should work like this. But you know, again, from a long historical perspective, it is there is no reason to have these assumptions, because the neoliberal order itself was just a particular moment in the history of capitalism. It was preceded by another order, the Keynesian economic order of the post-war years, that was governed by very different principles and by a very different understanding of what is so-called natural. And of course, a world in which you were born into and which was made to be natural, it's tough to leave that world behind. It's almost like an earthquake. You know, you trust that the ground on which you stand is stable. And if you are ever having lived through an earthquake, you know, the most terrifying thing is that this basic truth about life is not true any longer. And this is just truly terrifying. And I think this is a good, this helps us understand also our economic life today. In a way, we are living through an earthquake. The earth on which we stand doesn't seem to be stable any longer. And of course, we need to navigate that. And I'm not advocating for that. I'm not saying, okay, it's great. You know, we should have like massive tariffs and we should stop trading with one another. I'm not advocating for that at all. I'm just observing as a historian that this is not, you know, this kind of regime change, this kind of change in the order of how capitalism is organized, is nothing new. In 1820, so much of the global economy was based on the labor of enslaved people on plantations in the Caribbean and in the Americas. That was considered to be kind of the natural order of things by most people, except perhaps for the enslaved and those who fought against slavery. But it was seen to be kind of the natural order, a kind of God-given order, that this, and there was the sense that this order must kind of continue. And of course, a few decades later, this order completely collapsed and we entered a completely different moment in the history of capitalism again. So these kinds of even drastic and radical changes are absolutely nothing new in capitalism. And in a way, I think these are also moments of opportunity, because when you live in the middle of a particular order within capitalism, like the neoliberal order, it was very difficult to imagine even a different world, because it was considered to be the natural way of how things worked. Hmm. But now this has been opened up. You know, we can imagine different things. And so we should. We should imagine
and
different
things. And when you contrast, when you talk about the earthquake and the ground that we're standing on being the neoliberal order of the past half century, rather than an intrinsic version of capitalism in and of itself, what is capitalism exactly? You know, you've written a book entitled Capitalism, and if you ask some people, then capitalism just means the rapacious greed of the powerful being inflicted in unchecked ways on other people, and capitalism is colonialism, capitalism is imperialism, capitalism is inequality, capitalism is the profit motive steamrolling people's lives. And then you ask other people, and capitalism is the most productive way for human beings to flourish, to express their liberty, to trade with one another, to seek better lives, to uplift themselves. What do we mean by capitalism? Who's right?
Look, I think both of these descriptions are in some ways, you know, historically true. I mean, you can tell both of these stories. And in some ways, we need to keep both of these stories in play when we want to understand the history of capitalism. But look, I don't think capitalism can be defined as rich people kind of, you know, stealing the resources of poorer people, because if that would be the definition of capitalism, you know, it's in feudal Europe, for example, we would find societies in which also rich people kind of exploited the peasants and took their little surplus to build beautiful castles and churches and all of that. So I don't think that defines capitalism. I think this would be a very bad way of going about it, and defining capitalism as a society in which people just get wealthier and wealthier would also not be, I think, a very precise definition of what capitalism is. So for me, as we already discussed, capitalism shifts its shape drastically over time. The capitalism of the merchant communities of the 14th century is very different from the kind of slave capitalism of the 16th century that you find in Barbados. That is very different from the industrial capitalism you find in Manchester in the 1850s. And that, again, is very different from the kind of financial capitalism you would find in New York City in the 1980s or 1990s. So capitalism changes changes drastically. And also at any given moment, capitalism is very different in different parts of the world. So, you know, in today, let's say, you know, the way how capitalism is organized in the country of Cambodia, about which I write a fair amount, and let's say the United Kingdom or Australia is quite radically different. But despite all of these differences, there is something that all of these societies have in common. And what they have in common is that they live within an economic logic in which privately owned capital is productively invested with the purpose of generating more capital. And I think this is the basic logic that unifies all of these different
and
societies.
Sorry, Sven, what is capital?
Capital is kind of the resources that are productively invested to grow itself. It's a kind of process.
So it can be money, it can be a factory, it can be a mountain that has iron ore in it.
Yes, right. yes, among other things, yes. And all of these societies have that in common. And that, of course, explains the enormous dynamic of capitalism, because capitalism cannot stand still. Capitalism cannot be conservative. Some people think capitalism is a capitalist society is a kind of conservative society. It's just the opposite. It's a state of permanent revolution. This kind of society is expansive, which of course has as one of the results that we produce ever more, and that has, you know, a lot of beneficial effects on many people's lives. But it also explains this kind of expansionary thrust of capitalism, right? Capitalism expands constantly, both in space into new kinds of territories, but also into new spheres of life. So, for example, that we now, you know, buy and sell data. That is something that is quite recent, right? That's not a spatial expansion of capitalism. That is an expansion of capitalism within social life itself. And then we see, of course, spatial expansions. So I write about Cambodia and kind of how the capitalist revolution came to Cambodia in the past 30 years or so. But it's a system that is constantly in movement. It's constantly expanding.
How did the capitalist revolution come to Cambodia?
The capitalist revolution came to Cambodia in the wake of the terrifying regime of the Khmer Rouge and the various wars that occurred there. And it began
just for people who don't know Cambodia. This was a very backward, extremely communist, authoritarian regime of terror, partly spawned out of the Vietnam War, but partly indigenous to Cambodia.
Right. And you know, out of this war came, when this war ended, some of the former warlords and some of the people who were involved in channeling international aid into Cambodia, they kind of began to set up as entrepreneurs. And they invested in things such as palm oil plantations. They invested in tourist infrastructures. They invested in casinos, often along with Chinese capital. And they invested in a huge textile sector. About 1 million Cambodian women now work in the textile industry. And all of that happened just in a few years. Yeah, it's one of the most rapid transformations, and there you see kind of the power of capitalism. You know, how quickly it can turn a society upside down. It of course has sometimes terrifying consequences, but it also has this enormous power and this enormous.
Is the average Cambodian better off?
I think the average Cambodian is better off. Yes. The average Cambodian, I mean, average GDP does rise, but Cambodia is a society of extreme inequality in which there's a tiny minority of people who own almost everything.
And so when you talk about capitalism being defined by the reinvestment of capital, of stuff, of resources, mm-hmm. back into more productive pursuits so that you can create more wealth. There, part of the disillusionment, I think, that we currently hear about capitalism is the idea that it actually is no longer about great industrialists building great trains and, you know, reinvesting the profits from the train lines into some other great thing that benefits everybody, that now it's a bunch of people in the City of London or on Wall Street slicing and dicing and micromanaging fiber optic proximity to data centers in order to predict the movement of some number on a screen. And in that prediction, they're going to skim some money off the top and get fabulously wealthy and buy a place in the Hamptons and have a yacht and a private jet. What is the utility of that kind of financial capitalism that now comprises, I think, a larger portion of the economy than it ever has?
No, this has become clearly important to contemporary capitalism, but I think it would be wrong to see contemporary capitalism only characterized by these kinds of economic activities, because at the same time, we see worldwide a massive expansion of manufacturing. We have more factories and we produce more things than we ever did, but the factories that turn out all of that stuff are not any longer located in the Midlands, in the UK, or in the Midwest of the United States, but increasingly they are located in Asia, in China, and elsewhere. So I think it too much of an emphasis on the financial sector is a kind of Eurocentric or America-centric perspective on capitalism that leaves out very important sectors of the global capitalist economy. And therefore, again, a global approach, which I take in this book, is really crucial to understand also contemporary capitalism. That said, in some ways, kind of the enormous importance of finance capital and merchants is also not completely new in the history of capitalism, because this is how capitalism came about. It emerged out of these trading communities, out of merchant communities. And of course, these merchant communities, they also created financial mechanisms and they speculated in all kinds of things. So that in itself is also not totally historically new. And in some ways, the moment in which the people who make things were dominant within global capitalism was a relatively short one. It was a moment that perhaps began in the 1850s and ended sometime in the 1970s or 1980s. So it was like a little bit more than 100 years. And now again, this kind of financial merchant capital is clearly dominant in global capitalism. And yes, of course, people would say that this is an crucial part of the kind of efficiencies of the global capitalist economy, because people allocate capital to where it is most efficiently used. And of course, there is a role of that. But then there is also a lot of, as you say, there's a lot of non-productive activity within that, and kind of minor, the speculation on minor price movements and things like that. So there is a critique of a capitalist economy that is so clearly focused on the finance sector. But again, I don't think that's like the entire global capitalist economy. It's an important part in the parts of the world that we inhabit. I mean, maybe Australia is actually different, because Australia has a huge extractive economy. As you know, Australia produces a lot of stuff, you know, heavy stuff that is moved around on trucks and huge ships.
Yes. Although, I mean, it is still, it still makes a lot of money out of services, education, foreign students coming to study in our universities, tourism, arts, they're still a pretty big part of the economy. But yes, mining is huge. It's interesting that the emphasis on the financial sector, when all you have to do is open Instagram and look at all of the ads from Temu for a $2.99 automatic back scratcher from Shenzhen, and you realize financial services is not the only story in global capitalism. There's also a lot of shit floating around the world that we're ordering.
No, absolutely. I mean, look, we produce spectacularly more stuff than we ever have in human history, and it the total output of stuff is is growing exponentially, which is partly why we put so much pressure on the natural environment, because we need more and more things. We need more and more things that come out of these Australian mines to feed that system of ever expanding production of stuff.
And so the early days of capitalism, you talk about the Arab world, you talk about Syria and Yemen, then called Aden, as places which we often associate with the souks and the markets and the bazaars and the beginning of sort of this trading culture. But one of the remarkable innovations of capitalism was not just that people traded their things for money, but that people started not carrying their shit around with them to sell, and found ways of trading on paper. Can you explain how that happened?
Right. So the book starts, as you mentioned, it starts in the port of Aden in modern-day Yemen in the year 1150. And I chronicle in a kind of some detail the workings of a group of merchants in that port. And these merchants traded horses, they traded textiles, they traded spices, they traded gold with their counterparts in other parts of the world, such as on the west coast of India, on the east coast of Africa, in northern Africa, but also into Europe. And I describe that word not because this is literally where capitalism was born, but I describe this word because it is one of many of these merchant communities that begin to expand in the first half of the second millennium, in the year between 1000 and 1500. And I argue that this is kind of this is where the capitalist logic begins to take on its dynamic. It's strikingly modern. When we read the letters of these merchants, we find them strikingly modern. We immediately understand what it is they're doing. But in the world in which they lived, they were completely marginal. They, you know, most people organized their economic lives along very different kinds of logics.
What logic? And in what, some what ways, would have the, been the logic of an economic life prior to capitalism?
The vast majority of humans on planet Earth would have organized their economic life by focusing on securing the subsistence of their families and the subsistence maybe of their community, their village. And then other parts of the world, there were feudal lords, tributary rulers, who basically exploited the peasants. I think these were the two kind of dominant logics organizing economic life in much of the world. And there comes in this capitalist logic, which is very different. But it's very marginal. And in some ways, the book describes how we get from a world in which this logic is very marginal and it's just limited to what I call these islands of capital, to a word that we already discussed, namely the word of Cambodia, where this logic now suddenly structures everything. And of course, okay, so to come back more directly to your question, to organize some of this trade that these merchants now embark upon, they invent new kinds of tools that enable that. For example, they enable ways to transfer capital over very large distances. They find ways to limit their risk because international trade across the ocean was extremely risky and often failed. And they try to find ways to kind of limit their risks. And so they created ways to combine their capital, to share journeys of a boat across the Indian Ocean or down the coast of Africa. So they invented new tools in order to facilitate that kind of activity. And those tools became, of course, institutionally crucial to the kind of longer history of capitalism. And in some ways, that is still those tools, those institutions still are very important to capitalism.
What kind of tools are those?
Like, for example, to find to transfer bills of exchange that allowed the transfer of money across large distances, the creation of companies, so the pooling of capital and the mechanisms how that capital is pooled, and some agreements then on who bears the risk and what kind of risk and how much of it. That is, you know, the I mean, obviously companies, as the word says, companies are still quite important to the world today. So these are, you know, these are kind of very modern. I mean, these are things that are still very much crucial to contemporary capitalism, but they emerge out of this world of trade and the particular kind of opportunities and risks that merchants in the Middle Ages.
So just
faced.
To clarify, what was revolutionary about this trading model? Prior to that, people would generally grow stuff, have some livestock, maybe. They'd either give a portion of it to their feudal lord or they'd share it with their community. But even in those days, there were still blacksmiths, and like there were still coins in ancient Persia and Egypt, and like the concept of having currencies that represented some sort of value. So what is different about that than what you're talking about?
Yes, it's true. These kinds of merchant communities that we just discussed also existed in earlier times, but I start in the first half of the second millennium because, you know, you have to start somewhere, but it's also because they become much more important. So they expand quite significantly. But you know, if you want, you can trace some of that logic also into earlier times. And look, I think all of human history, as far as we can tell, all of human history has known of markets. People have exchanged goods on markets, as far as we know, in all human societies. So that, as such, is not.
Do you mean even if that's just bartering? Even if I'm a blacksmith and I make something and I exchange it for some wheat?
Exactly. There was the baker or the blacksmith, and so these were kind of local level exchanges.
Right. Yeah?
And they have existed, as far as we can tell, in all human societies. But even though they are even though there is, of course, trade, and even though there are markets, but both the trade and the markets are kind of on the margins of economic life. It's, you know, most of the things that the family would produce would, you know, not be used for barter, but it would be used for home consumption. People would produce their own textiles and, you know, and would dress themselves with things that they made themselves. But maybe they didn't make the shoes themselves. So maybe they purchased the shoes from some shoemaker who was in that village. So a market economy is not the same as capitalism. I mean, that is here the argument, yeah? Markets have existed for a long time, and I don't think they do define capitalism.
Right. So the market means I need some shoes, and I'm good at farming wheat, so I give some wheat to the shoemaker and he gives me shoes. That's a market trade. The difference with capitalism is that people accumulate the value of all of their shoes or their wheat or whatever, and then try to expand the value of their holding by giving it to other people who are doing productive things most productively, and then taking an investment in that and getting some of the profits of the expansion of the other person's output. Is that right?
Yes, that is correct. The basic logic in capitalism is not to stay with the shoemaker or the baker. It's not, you know, let's find a way to produce more shoes or let's find a way to produce more bread. But the primary propelling force is the desire to produce more capital. And, you know, if you have to produce more shoes or have to produce more bread in order to do so, that's of course, one of the welcome outcomes of this process. But the primary goal is here the accumulation of capital, to produce more capital. And that is not the case in let's say, most medieval societies in which the market, in which there is a market, but the market is kind of, you know, it's a limited sphere. It's a limited part of economic life. Now, fast forward to today, and that's exactly what this book does. You know, today, almost everything we do is embedded within markets. We, you know, we acquire, you know, presumably you don't produce your own textiles. You presumably don't grow your own
food. They wouldn't be very good textiles.
You might not grow your own food because you go to a restaurant and have somebody else cook it. So almost all that we consume is produced and exchanged on markets. And of course, also what we do to earn a living is largely oriented towards the market. We work, most of us work for wages, so there is a kind of market transaction. So this is a radical departure in human history. This is very different from how economic life on planet Earth was organized throughout much of human history. And the book exactly tries to do this, to explain, you know, how come that this logic that was once very weird and strange and kind of revolutionary in also in opposition to the existing logics of economic life, how did this come to kind of dominate all of economic life on planet Earth? This is, you know, we take living in capitalism now to be almost like, you know, natural. It's like we live in capitalism like fish live in water. Yes, but we need to think this is a historical, that's the result of a historical process. And we need to understand how we came to live in a world like this, which is such a radical departure from prior human.
And Sven, when you say that the defining feature of capitalism is that the participants are seeking to expand their capital, to increase their capital, that can sound quite limited, selfish, arbitrary. Like, why are we playing this game at all? Like, how does the average Cambodian get rich just because a tiny minority of people who have lots of capital are trying to increase their capital? It sort of sounds like trickle-down economics, because presumably not every participant in the capitalist economy is trying to increase their capital. It's only the people who have enough capital to do so.
That's also very much true. And look at the results of, you know, what you get out of that logic is tremendous productivity increases. We produce so much more stuff. And of course, collectively, many people on planet Earth, not all people on planet Earth, but many people on planet Earth have greatly benefited from that. You know, everything around us in some ways is a result of this capitalist revolution. We live longer lives. We live healthier lives. There are many more of us. On average, we're taller than previously because we have access to better nutrition. So this is all the result of this particular logic. But how this is distributed, you know, the fruits of this is, of course, very different in different moments in time and also in different societies. But let's say, because you spoke about Cambodia, you know, that there were true limits to agrarian life in Cambodia, to put it like that. There was just, you know,
there's only so much rice that a single woman can make in a day.
Yes, exactly. There are real limits on how much a family can produce. Life could be quite miserable in the Cambodian countryside. Land was not always accessible, or was divided up among the children, and thus became smaller and smaller. And now, for, you know, especially for women, there are now opportunities, let's say, to take the truck down to Phnom Penh and start working in a textile factory that doesn't pay particularly well. If you think about average wages in Australia, it pays about $200 a month. But of course, this is kind of much more than would be available by continuing to grow rice in the countryside. And so,
the reason for that, Sven, just to understand the dynamic correctly, the reason the woman can earn more at the textile factory in Phnom Penh than in the countryside harvesting rice is because the assets, I'm trying to avoid the word capital because it sounds so wonky, but the resources that the person who owns the factory has are maximized by investment in that factory over the opportunity costs of other things that they could be doing with that money. And that's because those people are willing to pay more for the textiles that the factory produces than they are for the rice that the woman would produce, right?
Yeah, I mean, and there's obviously huge demand globally for textiles. Labor is much cheaper in Cambodia than, let's say, in Australia, and for that reason, very few T-shirts are manufactured in Australia. So there is a market, you know, and people elsewhere outside of Cambodia are willing to purchase these products, and that makes, of course, the investment of capital in the Cambodian textile industry makes that profitable. So this is all part of, you know, this cannot be explained by only looking at the history of Cambodia. You need to look at You know, this
right. Because Cambodians aren't buying the T-shirts. It's we who are buying the T-shirts.
Some of them, but the vast majority of the production goes abroad, and especially to China, but also to Europe, the United States, Australia. So you know, this is part of a kind of much larger global system. You cannot even begin to understand the kind of capitalist revolution in Cambodia without also embedding it into a global history, which is what the book does throughout. You know, it tries to. It looks often at very local places. It looks, for example, at, you know, the Industrial Revolution in Scotland in the 1800s. It looks at the emergence of industry in India in the 1950s through kind of a detailed analysis of just one company. But what we see when we look at these very local situations and particular sets of people, small groups of people, we must embed them into this larger global narrative to understand their very local histories. And that is definitely also the case when we look at the kind of capitalist revolution coming to Cambodia.
You mentioned the Industrial Revolution in Scotland. What role did the Enlightenment, Adam Smith, and the Industrial Revolution play, and how are they connected?
So the Industrial Revolution, I argue, is one of the most important events in human history, because this is the moment when, you know, modern economic growth, as we know it, first came about. And it has made a huge difference to the lives of almost everybody on planet Earth in the 200 years after the Industrial Revolution. And we need to understand the Industrial Revolution not so much as the beginning of capitalism, as, you know, when we talked about definitions of capitalism, some people kind of define capitalism at this moment as emerging with the Industrial Revolution. But I see the Industrial Revolution as the most important offspring of the capitalist revolution, which itself is much older, as we already discussed in some detail. And I think this Industrial Revolution, even though it first happens, as you know, in just a small part of the world, in the, you know, northern England and then also in Scotland. So it's kind of a very local history, but it is deeply embedded in the kind of global networks and this kind of global capitalism that was built by these merchants that we discussed earlier. It was built upon, you know, access to Indian cotton textiles, thanks to the East India Company. It was also built upon access to South Asian technology in dyeing and printing cotton textiles. It was based on land in the Americas where the cotton used in the factories was grown. It was built upon the labor of people from Africa who were enslaved to grow that cotton in the Caribbean and Brazil and then the United States. And it was built upon these upon global markets. I mean, the Brits, very soon after they invented a more productive way of spinning and weaving, they export a very large share of their product into many parts of the world. By the mid-19th century already, India is the most important market for the Lancashire textile industry. So I explained that Industrial Revolution basically as a kind of result of this peculiar conjunction of global developments and a kind of almost like an accidental development that in some ways was very unlikely, but when it happened, it developed great dynamism. And of course, you need to think about the world in particular ways to imagine, for example, the more productive way of spinning cotton. And so, you know, what has been called Enlightenment thought or the Industrial Enlightenment does feed into that kind of rethinking of the way how humans work and produce. But I think this cannot explain the story out of itself. Because, you know, obviously, partly the Enlightenment, I mean, we see certain kind of Enlightenment traditions also in other parts of the world. So this is not like a uniquely European development. And then we also see that, of course, this new way of thinking about the world is in itself partly a result of European expansion into the world. The ability to observe this world, to see this world, to travel the world has an impact on how Enlightenment thinkers begin to think about the world in which they live in. So I think this all needs to be kind of kept in view at the same time. It's you know, I hate any kind of monocausal explanations.
Yeah.
You need to keep a lot of things in mind. But what I think, what I emphasize in this book in particular is you need to keep always in mind the kinds of global connections in which things are embedded. You cannot explain anything out of itself. You know, you cannot write a local history. You know, it's strikingly obvious if we talk about Australia. You know, you cannot explain Australia out of itself. You cannot explain Australian capitalism, let's say, and not look at some other part of the world. Maybe in Australia that is completely self-evident and nobody in their right mind
would ever think about it. That no one would be under that delusion.
Yeah, and maybe it's also the peculiar structure of Australian capitalism. But believe me, in the United States, there are many people who think, you know, you can explain American capitalism just purely out of itself, which is totally impossible. Right. You need to always think about it in its global embedded.
And so we spent a bit of time talking about the difference on the ground in Yemen, for example, when the old way of just growing things for yourself and bartering a bit with your neighbors suddenly was confronted with this revolutionary idea of tracing values on ledgers and sending currencies over across the seas. What was the similar on-the-ground change in the Industrial Revolution? What happened in Northern England and Scotland that would have been so revolutionary over the course of the decades under which in which it unfolded?
So what happened is new ways. I mean, at the core of it was at first a new way, a new technique of spinning cotton, which was drastically more productive. I mean, about 200 times more productive than using a spinning wheel, you know, which obviously many people had in their homes to spin cotton and then to weave it on the loom, which was a very common activity in many parts of the world. So there was a new technique of doing that. That technique now demanded demanded larger buildings. It couldn't be accommodated anymore. You couldn't have a water frame. You couldn't house that in your little farmhouse. You needed larger buildings. So this is when the modern factory emerges. Then to power these machines, you needed to have access to non-animal or non-human power. So at first, it's largely water power, which you had a lot, both in Northern England, but especially in Scotland. And later, of course, the use of fossil fuels. So this is the beginning of what I call the fossil fuel civilization.
Meaning then, coal back then?
Coal at the beginning, mostly coal. Throughout the 19th century, it was basically exclusively coal. And then, of course, oil and gas in the 20th century. And then what you also needed, you had these very large machinery in these very large buildings, relatively speaking, that were powered by, the machinery was powered by fossil energy or by water power. You needed many more people to work these machines. So suddenly, it wasn't like the old cobbler who had like an apprentice, you know, there were two people kind of making the shoes, but suddenly you need, let's say, 200 people to work on these machines. And these people became kind of the first group of modern wage workers, which are, you know, now so common in the world. And they were not to become owners of cotton factories. They didn't become master artisans as people, let's say the cobbler apprentice would have become later a master cobbler. They were workers. They started out in the world as wage workers, often at a very young age, at age 8 or 9. Many, especially girls, would start working in cotton factories. And they would spend, you know, much of their lives working in these factories. So this was a drastic, so this wasn't just a change in technology. It wasn't just a change in how machines were powered. It wasn't just a change in how work was organized, but it was also drastic social change because suddenly you had people who were not anymore, you know, living on farms and somehow making a living in the countryside. You had people who lived in cities who were completely dependent on their industrial employment. And that gave them now, I mean, this is one of the reasons of why this logic, this capitalist logic now comes to encompass many more people and many more spheres of life, because these people now also, you know, they didn't grow their own food, so they had to purchase their food on markets. They didn't, even though they spun and wove all day, but they probably didn't make their own clothing, so they had to buy that on markets as well. So this is a social change of greatest greatest significance. This is where the modern world in which we live in right now, when this word came into being, and when you read, I cite in the book quite a few kind of contemporary travelers who visit these places, you know, like middle class travelers coming from London or New York or elsewhere. They go into this world of the factory, they look at it, they visit it, and they're truly shocked in what they see. They see it as a kind of gate to hell,
the dark satanic mills.
This is very interesting. I cite some of these sources in the book. You know, people who came out of the Scottish countryside and entered the factory owners often complained that these people were literally afraid of the factory. They thought of the factory as a kind of monster that would kind of eat them up. So they were very reluctant to go into the factory. It was kind of the last thing you would do, you know, that when you had no choices anymore, you would send your children and then your wife into the factory. And maybe in the end, the husband would enter the factory.
And so I think that precise conundrum, that revolution from an agrarian, perhaps more, well, I don't want to put my thumb on the scale here, but critics of capitalism would say a more humane and stable and balanced relationship to family, community, and nature, evolving into this highly industrialized, I mean, you just mentioned in passing something that's also interesting in the book, which I hadn't really thought about, which is that for most of history, people have not worked for wages. It's unusual that we work and get paid. That's a, you know, an artifact of the Industrial Revolution. And out of that, you get the critique from Marx and Engels and others that what we are now basically seeing is an indentured class of quasi-slaves who have no other options except to work for the man, and industrialists who own capital can infinitely reinvest that capital and get more and more rich, and working people have no way out. And it strikes me that we're skipping over the 20th century here a lot, but I mean, fast forwarding to the 21st century, many people do feel that we are still in fundamentally that predicament, that the idea that a free market unleashes individual ingenuity and we can all become artisans or industrialists is belied by the reality of most people looking for a job, finding a wealthy corporation to give them a job, and then working for a wage over which they have very little bargaining power. How does that model, is that model, you know, inevitable to capitalism? Is there a way to turn the dial up on capitalism's ability to foster ingenuity, individualism, spontaneity, artisanship, industrialism?
Right. Look, that is difficult to say, because in the end, I can only report on the history as it actually happened.
Yeah, but you're a Harvard professor, so you know more than I do about this.
So you think I but I think you put your finger on something really, really important, namely that, you know, once upon a time, it was unusual to engage in wage labor. It wasn't completely unknown, but it was, let's say, quite unusual. And now much of the human population is engaging in various forms of wage labor. That is perhaps one of the most radical social changes that was brought about by the capitalist revolution. For most of us today, we see that almost as natural. We see, oh, you know, the world must have always worked that way. But as you pointed out very correctly, this is not how the world has always worked. Now, you know, we also, though, have to see that the conditions of wage work changed quite drastically, at least in significant parts of the world, since the 1780s. We clearly, you know, most of us get paid, let's say, much better than the children and women who worked in the Scottish textile mills. We work many fewer hours. I mean, people work like unbelievably long hours.
Because left-wing unions pushed back against capitalism and demanded rights?
I'll get there. Yes. So again, this, yes. Okay. So we work in a better working conditions than we used to. We have something called vacation time, which is something that people in the 18th century did did not enjoy. We have, in the 1780s, the Scottish manufacturers were very much opposed to any kind of public education for children because they thought this was just completely unnecessary for people who would end up working in the factories. Now, you know, we take it for granted that the state takes a certain interest in giving access to people, giving children access to pretty advanced educational opportunities. So there is a drastic change, which again speaks to how significantly change is under capitalism. Why does that change occur? And that goes back to your comment just right now, namely that workers from the very beginning they rebelled against the conditions under which they found themselves. They ran away. They left the factory. They tried to make a living in America, or eventually they might have embarked upon a trip across the world to come to Australia.
Only if they were criminals.
So they tried. I mean, that is also all linked. You know, this is all very much linked. But people try to get away from the world of the factory, which why sometimes they were lost. That forced people into the factory. They were not, you know, they were not allowed to leave the factory. They were forced to stay within the factory. But people did still rebel against the factory, and then later they organized in trade unions. They organized political parties that were focused in their activities on improving the situation of workers, of wage workers in these factories and also elsewhere. Cumulatively, you know, sometimes change was very slow, sometimes people in their own work lives didn't experience personally so much of a change in their pay, in their working conditions, in their benefits. But if we look at this again from a long historical perspective, we see that all of these efforts of workers to improve their lives have had a dramatic impact on wages, on working conditions, educational opportunities, and all of it. So this has changed capitalism quite fundamentally. And now, if you think about the worker at General Motors, or if you think a worker at Mercedes in Stuttgart, or if you think about probably mine workers in Australia, you know, people are significantly better paid. They have a kind of decent standard of living. Of course, this is also under threat. You know, it is far from stable. Nothing is stable under capitalism, but I'm just saying that the conditions changed quite drastically in the past 250 years. And in some ways, that was almost kind of a necessary counterpart to the productivity increases that were enabled by the capitalist revolution, because, you know, somebody had to buy all the things that came out of these factories. I mean, if workers don't get paid enough to buy things, then eventually, you know, there are only so many middle class people who can, who would be a potential market. And in an age of mass production, which really comes about in the later 19th century, in an age of mass production, of course, the size of the market came to matter greatly, which is why during the New Deal in the 1930s, there was a, you know, among economists and among policymakers, there was a real effort to expand the size of the market, to stabilize the market through the building of a massive welfare state, which has also improved conditions of labor.
And also, I assume that in terms of wage workers in Western countries in the 21st century, as automation has taken up a lot of low-skilled jobs, the ones who remain, the workers in the Mercedes factory in Germany or the miners in Australia, are actually highly skilled people who it's quite difficult to replace. I mean, it's not easy to work in a mine when it's automated as much as it can be. If you're one of the people who works there, you're an engineer. You're not a, you know, you don't have a coal pick at the coal face down a mine anymore. Lastly, Sven, I just want to end where we started, which was with Mamdani and tariffs and Trump and the future of capitalism, perhaps, because you said something at the beginning that caught my ear, which was about inequality in America and saying that this tiny fraction of the population are capturing all the gains of the increases in productivity. When you talk to a free market capitalist or a conservative Republican, they will say, well, these people aren't capturing gains as if the gains just happen automatically and they're stealing them. Jeff Bezos created a really efficient and cheap way to get stuff delivered to your house. and that has benefited all of us, and we all profit from that. And he keeps a small share of the increased productivity that he's created. Elon Musk just got his supposed $1 trillion payday, which is pegged to performance targets that are highly ambitious, which basically say, if I increase the value of this particular electric vehicle to the world by X, then I get to keep, you know, 1/10 or 1/5 of X. But the layperson's understanding of inequality is closer to what you said, which is the Bernie Sanders style version. These people are essentially mooching off the larger economy, which is true. And can you have that level of ingenuity without that level of reward?
I think you can. And historically, there are certainly moments when there are significant productivity increases and inequality is much more muted. And a very good example for that would be the United States in the 1950s and 1960s. We actually, in those two decades, we have significantly faster productivity growth than in the present. And at the same time, we had much lower levels of social inequality. Yes, you know, people invent new things, and that is often quite beneficial for society at large. You know, you mentioned the coal pick, and you know, in new ways of mining coal have you know, made that kind of labor less important, and maybe that's for the better, and maybe that's something we should celebrate. But there seems to be a built-in tendency within capitalism that kind of concentrates the gains of this particular logic of economic life in the hands of a very few, and that I think has a terrible implications for the lives of so many. It also, I think, makes what we started out talking about, namely the question of the political regime in which capitalism is embedded, it creates tensions within a liberal democratic society if so many people don't benefit from the productivity gains.
But just a question: the framing of concentrating productivity gains among the few, it sort of feels like the productivity gains are being treated as a given, whereas the industrialist would say, what productivity gains without me? Like, the economy didn't just magically create productivity gains. Jeff Bezos created Amazon. Rupert Murdoch created a media empire. Elon Musk created a new company. They all spun off enormous amounts of cash because they produced things like iPhones that lots of people want.
No, good for them, and that's what what we said all along, that there is something in the capitalist logic, and that propels these kinds of new ways of building things, creating things. It also propels the emergence of entirely new kinds of products that nobody in the past ever thought about, such as the iPhone. So that's all great. But there seems to be a tendency within the logic of capitalism itself that relatively few people benefit, capture most of the benefits that come out of these kinds of innovation. And I think that makes that is in the long term is politically unsustainable. That's what I would argue. It is politically unsustainable. It also creates certain kinds of economic problems. So now there's a lot of reporting here in the United States that, you know, the only dynamic expanding part of the market is among the very wealthy, that most Americans are actually, you know, having increasing problems to maintaining their standard of living. So that has also then an impact on the size of the market. And then last but not least, the history of capitalism shows that there can be various kinds of inequality regimes within capitalism. And it's really more of a political decision what kind of inequality regime we favor. There was a lot of innovation in the United States in the 1950s and 1960s. There was a lot of innovation in the country of Sweden in the 1960s and 1970s, which had drastically less inequality even than the United States. So I don't think that innovation is positively correlated to greater degrees of inequality. I think just the opposite, and And also we are now capable of producing so many things, much more than ever before in human history. And, you know, we should celebrate that, and we should, but we should also consider how that kind of unprecedented productivity can make life better for not just the few, but for everyone.
And so your response to American conservatives who say that there's something fundamentally uncapitalist about arguing for socially democratic policies would be what?
The answer would be that this is, social democracy has coexisted with capitalism for more than 100 years, and I don't see any contradiction here.
Sven, thank you for being on the show. It's lovely to talk to you.
Thank you so much. Great talking to you.